Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Dr. Susan Gubar, Distinguished Professor of English at Indiana University. Dr. Gubar, along with Sandra Gilbert, is the author of the groundbreaking work, The Mad Woman in the Attic, as well as No Man's Land, a three-volume set exploring women's literature. She has also written Race Changes, Poetry After Auschwitz, recently published Rooms of Our Own, and working on an upcoming biography of Judas. Welcome to Profile, Susan.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me start out by asking you, what drew you to study women's literature specifically? This is in the early 70s, right, that we're
talking
about?
Right. I arrived in Bloomington in 1973 with a training in English literature that included the study of almost no women. Jane Austen was taught at that time, but that was pretty much it, maybe a little bit of Emily Dickinson. And so there was no such field as women's literature or women's studies, for that matter, nor was there feminist approaches to literature. And so I was hired to teach 18th century literature. And the paradoxical situation was that I decided to teach a course with Sandra Gilbert because she was new to the faculty, as I was, and because she was commuting in part, and it was a way of making her life a little bit easier.
And her specialty was in 20th century poetry, if I remember
20th
correctly.
20th century poetry, and mine was 18th century literature. And we had no common ground, and we were getting to know each other, and we discovered that, in fact, what we shared was a really from childhood a love of works like Jane Eyre, Little Women, a great appreciation for Austen and Virginia Woolf. And that was what we had in common in terms of our love of literature, which was a subject neither one of us had studied. So we thought, well, we'll be equally ignorant and we'll be able to teach this course together. And we were planning a course and thinking about what to call it, because it was going to be a senior seminar. Ordinarily, senior seminars had 15 students, but because there were two of us, we were going to have 30 students. And we thought maybe we'd call it Upstairs, Downstairs to get at the ways in which some women are very privileged and some women are very poor. And then we started thinking about Jane Eyre, and Sandra came up with the idea of Bertha Mason Rochester, the mad woman in the attic of Jane Eyre, and how important she was in that text. And we kind of thought about, well, let's call the course The Mad Woman in the Attic. And the book came out of the course.
And the book really takes a look at women's literature from a very different perspective than had been done before. I mean, I was a student of literature in the early 70s, and we studied very few women. Gertrude Stein.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about how you began looking at the different perspectives of looking at women's literature?
Well, the real breakthrough idea, which was something other people were beginning to do also, was to think about the commonality among women writers and their texts. What do they share? What kinds of images do they share? The idea of Bertha Mason Rochester is that she's not the heroine of the text. She's in a kind of pocket of the text, up in the attic, and a kind of secret in the text until halfway through, in fact. But what we decided or began to see in a lot of other texts was the ways in which her anger at her entrapment and at her silencing and her being treated as an invisible kind of monster haunting the house, the patriarchal house of Thornfield Hall in Charlotte Bronte's novel, really characterized a lot of submerged anger, even in decorous writers like Emily Dickinson or Jane Austen. So the idea was really to think about what women had in common as writers in terms of images and concerns.
Talk to me a little bit about what, as a child, what drew you to, especially, you grew up in New York, in Brooklyn.
I did.
And here you are drawn to some of the great English writers.
Mm-hmm.
What drew you to them, and how did you think about your world compared to their world of the countryside and the manor?
You know, I wonder if part of it wasn't the romance of those texts. I mean, after all, Emma and Mrs. Knightley and Mr. Knightley end up happily ever after. Rochester and Jane end up happily ever after. I think part of it was the romance of the texts, but I think that there was also a sense of the difficulties of growing up as a young woman. And that was not that different I know Brooklyn seems very different from, let's say, Haworth in Yorkshire. But in fact, the sense that Jane Eyre has of being awkward, of being kind of orphaned, of being unable to speak, lacking confidence, wanting an education, those were things that a young girl in Brooklyn could very much relate to. I should add, too, that one of my favorite texts was Little Women, an American author. Mm-hmm. And I loved the character of Jo because she was a writer and she was full of imagination. And I was also very drawn to the ways in which she related to Meg and to Beth and the whole family situation. So I think the sense of women relating to other young women in these novels is very resonant for young readers.
You came out with some years later, and I can't remember the year exactly, with Race Changes, where you really started looking back at some of the things that had been left out, so to speak, of the earlier studies of feminist literature when you first can you talk a little bit about your own shift in perspective from between those two times, I guess the early 70s and the early 80s, right?
Sure. Well, Race Changes was the first book I wrote by myself. And it was a response to an earlier book Sandra and I had produced in that sequence, No Man's Land, mm-hmm. that you mentioned, the three-volume sequence. There was a book called Sex Changes. And it was about the ways in which women in the 20th century imagine sexual masquerade, transvestism, transsexuality in their work. And we had looked at a book by Ernest Hemingway about a woman who turns into a boy. And we had neglected to notice that although she does have a kind of sex change, it's called the Garden of Eden, mm-hmm. she also has a race change. She becomes African. She becomes darkened. And I hadn't seen that. And I was very shocked thinking about how I had been looking at sex and I had been looking at gender and I had factored out race. So Race Changes was an effort to understand what critical race scholars were doing and to make sense of it on my own terms. It's a study of cross-racial masquerade. Black people, of course, have always in slave times had to impersonate white people in order to get white privileges, so that light-skinned African Americans frequently passed for white in order to be able to vote, in order to be able to get jobs, in order to be able to move upward. But there's also a long history in American literature and film of white people impersonating black people. And I wanted
Al Jolson, for example.
Al Jolson would be the most famous example, the first talkie.
In the book, you were trying to explore that.
I wanted to understand the asymmetry of that. It seemed to me that it was quite obvious that African American people needed the privileges of whiteness, and so they were trying to pass. Whereas very often what you see among white writers taking on blackface is not an effort to pass at all, but to mimic, to stereotype, or to appropriate black culture, as in white hip-hop artists today.
Mm-hmm. In a lot of your books, you've explored, obviously, the issues of gender and the issues of class to some extent, mm-hmm. as well as the issues of race. Which do you think is the most difficult today for people to be able to talk about?
Well, that's a very difficult question. I think given the world today, ethnicity and religion, something I have not really dealt with very much in my work up to date, are very important and difficult issues given the kind of really dreadful violence we have going on, not just in Palestine and in Israel, but, you know, in Iraq, in Iran, the kind of issues about language, ethnicity, religious belief, and the ways in which they can create global violence seems to me right now one of the huge problems.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Dr. Susan Gubar, Distinguished Professor of English at Indiana University and the author of many books. One of the books that I was very interested in myself was Poetry After Auschwitz. And what made you turn in that direction to start looking at some of the writings after Auschwitz? And that title is also taken from quite a famous quote, if I'm correct.
Right. The title comes from Theodore Adorno's very famous sentence, "It's barbaric to write poetry after Auschwitz." That book is a very eccentric book in my history because it comes out of a very personal event. My mother is a survivor. My family left Germany after the Nuremberg laws had been passed, when Jews could not own property, vote, have non-Jews in their households. They couldn't use public transportation. They couldn't go to the parks. They couldn't use the swimming pools. They were basically becoming stigmatized. Right before Kristallnacht in 1938, my family left Germany. They were very lucky to be able to get out. Basically around the 80s, my mother started to go to a reunion of survivors in America, people who had been able to escape here, mm-hmm. and who would meet once every 4 years. And I was invited to come and speak. And it was a subject about which I knew very little, and I didn't have anything I wanted to say to these people. I wanted to listen to them rather than speak to them or at them. So I brought some poetry mm-hmm. By survivors and by non-survivors, and I read it to them. And really, that book came out of a sense of wanting to do something to honor my mother and her history.
And when you worked on that volume, what did it bring out to you about your own history as first-generation American, as someone who has the history of coming from a family of survivors? Did that shed any different light on the work that you had been doing or shift your perspective at all?
I think what it taught me is the extraordinary gap between the survivor and the child of the survivor, the ways in which one doesn't want to appropriate but wants to honor their experiences. But really, it's an experience I have not had myself. And that led me to a generation of American poets who are writing today who were not survivors, who are writing wonderful poetry about the Holocaust. People like Adrienne Rich or Charles Simic or C.K. Williams, Jacqueline Ashero, these are American-born people who were too young to have experienced the Holocaust and who, in any case, were born right here in America, who are writing extremely resonant poetry that both respects their inability to fully appreciate what happened in 1940 to 1942, and yet also tries to grapple with its resonance and its significance as a historical cataclysm.
Mm-hmm. You obviously, as we said before, grew up in Brooklyn, but you raised two daughters here in Bloomington?
Yes, I did.
How different was their childhood from your childhood?
Totally. I lived right in the middle of the country, right, in a little tiny town, a beautiful bucolic college town, Bloomington. For those people who have visited, know it's just extraordinarily beautiful. And they lived on a block where they could be out and about by themselves, and they knew everybody on the block. It was pastoral, bucolic.
Mm-hmm. And your childhood, I take it, was not as much.
No. We were quite poor. When Hitler allowed some Jews to leave, they left with nothing.
Mm-hmm. So your family circumstances changed greatly when they came to the United States.
Greatly.
Talk to me a little bit about how the shift was for you when you first came to Bloomington in the early 70s to this bucolic pastoral town that you talk about. What you think that change did to the way you viewed your work? What kind of an effect do you think it had?
Well, at the beginning, there was the culture shock of not being able to buy a bagel or the New York Times. That's no longer true. You can get anything here and everything as you could anywhere else. But the real effect of being in a college town like Bloomington for me has been a kind of asceticism that allows me to live inside my head as I'm writing my books. The world does not interfere that much. I mean, it's really a very privileged place to be. Fabulous library, wonderful internet access. But more to the point, if you wish to insulate yourself mentally in a project, you can. The world is not constantly bombarding you with stimuli.
And do you think it does even on an academic campus, say in New York City or Chicago or...
Oh, I think just getting on the subway or a bus in New York or Chicago is being bombarded by extraordinarily stimulating experiences and people, but it's a very different way to live.
One of the things I'm always curious about is, as a professor, part of your day is spent turning outward and sharing what you know and trying to inspire other younger people to take up academics. How do you balance that with, as you called it, retreating into your own mind to be able to delve further into your own studies?
Well, I don't only teach students to become professors. I pretty much every year try to teach a large freshman course. My goal is not to have students become professors. My goal in a class like that is to help students enjoy reading the signs of their times. It's to help them become more adept at interpreting and enjoying literature, but also interpreting film, interpreting TV, thinking about advertisements, learning how to become sort of conscious of the culture in a way that is not passive but active. So for me, that's a great pleasure. And I think that if I were only doing the aesthetic writing interior thing, I would be terribly bored.
Talk to me a little bit about Rooms of Our Own, because I think that's a reflection of some of your goals in teaching as well as some of your concerns.
Yeah, Rooms of Our Own is a book that has not yet been published. It's coming out in October or November. And it's set on a campus very much like Bloomington, although its narrator should not be in any way confused with me. She is childless. She is not married. She's a little bit younger than I am. But it's in a way an effort to understand through 1 year in the life of an English professor what the situation of women is today. I hope that readers will be able to compare what my narrator confronts on a campus now with what Virginia Woolf's narrator confronted when she went to a campus in 1928. She went to what she called Oxbridge, which was an acronym for Oxford and Cambridge. And many things have changed for women between 1928 and today, and yet many things have not changed, and some things have gotten worse. So I, without preaching, I want to tell a story that will enable us to understand what we've achieved and what we still have left to accomplish.
Let me ask you a few questions about the book itself. It's not a novel, and it's not exactly literary criticism. What would you call the form of the book?
I call it narrative criticism because it has characters and has graduate student characters, undergraduate characters. It has professors. It has locations like the business school, like the Arboretum. On one mystic walk, my narrator notices the orange donut in front of the art museum and the beautiful sculpture of the founder with his hand raised. So it's very much about the scenes that we confront in Bloomington every day. But on the other hand, I'm also trying to think about the history of feminist criticism over the past 5 years, how we've moved from the study of images of women, women's literature, critical race studies, the effect of post-structuralism, sexuality studies, post-colonialism, globalism, bioengineering. All of these things have affected our conversations about women. So narrative on the one hand, criticism on the other. It's a kind of hybrid.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit more about some of the differences and similarities that you alluded to in terms of where we are today as women. But before we do that, I want to take a moment to listen to one of your favorite pieces of music, which is Mary Hamilton by Joan Baez. Can you tell me why you picked that piece?
Well, A Room of One's Own is based on this ballad. Virginia Woolf knew the ballad and knew that her readers would know the ballad. In fact, she says about her narrator, "Call me Mary Beaton, Mary Seton, Mary Carmichael, or me." And that line comes directly from the ballad Mary Hamilton. That's the one that Joan Baez is singing.
Word is to the kitchen gone, and word is to the hall, and word is up to that Mary Hamilton's born a babe to the highest steward of all. Arise, arise, Mary Hamilton.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Susan Gubar. You've been listening to Mary Hamilton, which is a traditional ballad sung by Joan Baez. Just before the music, we were talking a little bit about some of the similarities and differences that women face today over the course of the last century, more or less. Can you talk about what some of those similarities are and some of those differences?
Well, one of the huge differences is that Wolfe is not allowed to go into the library at Cambridge. She's certainly not allowed to teach or even to study at Oxford. Women were not allowed into those schools in 1928. Here, we have a school that's been coeducational for quite some time, and we have women as students, as teachers, as administrators. So there is that kind of pedagogic change is extraordinary.
And what are some of the similarities that you see?
Some of the similarities have to do with the issue, for example, of women's health and welfare. We live in a culture that is still dramatically and unfortunately too often harmful to women. This book is dedicated to Jill Behrman and to Susan Clemens. Jill Behrman is the name that many of your listeners will know, a young woman who was killed a few years ago now. Mm-hmm. Susan Clemens was a graduate student of mine who was killed in Eigenmann and who was a brilliant young woman. In this country, we have a rape every 6 minutes. Now, this is actually better than it was 10 or 15 years ago when it was a rape every 3 minutes. But domestic violence and violence against women, rape, are still enormous problems.
Tell me a little bit, in the early 70s, when you first began delving into women's literature, the new wave feminism at that point, or second wave feminism, was just developing. How has your own view of feminism shifted from the early 70s to now in 2006?
I think in the 70s, Sandra and I tended to talk about the mad woman as a singular person. We produced in 1985 a book called The Norton Anthology of Literature by Women, and its subtitle was A Tradition in English. We were thinking about a kind of monolithic tradition, singular, in English that all women participated in. When we brought out the second edition of the book in the 90s, we called it The Norton Anthology of Literature by Women, Traditions, plural, in English. And I think that probably encapsulates my sense that I've become, because the women's movement has become more aware of the differences between and among women from different backgrounds, ethnicities, races, religions, geographies, ages, sexualities. We're much more aware of that now than we were in the 70s.
What do you think are some of the things that caused that awareness to shift for you?
It seems to me that what made the biggest difference in multiplying our understanding of women's experiences was the work of African-American feminist scholars. They, in the 80s in particular, produced a host of essays and books protesting the ways in which womanhood had been just unconsciously raced white. And after them, I think people in Chicana studies, Asian American studies, and cultural studies have also, you know, contributed to making more complex our understanding of women's different situations.
Yeah, I think the way that the civil rights movement and the women's movement have dovetailed throughout the years, there seems to be a connection. Have you thought about that at all as your work has developed?
Well, in the 19th century, an enormous number of the feminists who evolved and brought together the first conventions for suffrage came out of the abolition movement. Seneca Falls event really came out of, and people like Sojourner Truth or Susan B. Anthony were not allowed to speak at abolition meetings because of their, not because of their race, because one was black and the other white, but because of their gender. And then they started moving into women's suffrage, and same thing with civil rights, as you pointed out. Women active in civil rights had to take a secondary position, and somehow that sparked their awareness of their own biases, their own difficulties.
How do you think the perspective of your students over the last, is it 30-odd years? It is. 30-odd years have shifted. What kind of changes do you see in the way that they perceive feminism and the way they perceive literature and literature studies?
I think that the change has not been as great as other people seem to have noticed. I've always had students who begin the class saying, I'm not a feminist, but. There's something about the F word that makes them feel that they need to disavow it at the beginning. I've seen that, though, over the years, you know, in the 70s, in the 80s, I see it now. What happens after I'm not a feminist, but, what happens after the but is, of course, I think women should have equal pay for equal work. I think women should have control over their own bodies. I think women need to have, you know, research done on their problems as it is done for men on their health problems. It sounds very much like what one would ordinarily call feminism. So I think we've always been struggling to make the word feminism resonant and to make it alive and attractive. It's just been a problem we've always had.
Why do you think it's so scary about the word?
It's been mocked ever since it came into being, since, you know, the 18th and 19th centuries. So I'm not quite sure why.
It's interesting. When I heard you read the other night from Rooms of Our Own, and you used the word masquerade. That came up a lot. And before, a little earlier in our conversation, we were talking about the book Race Changes, and you were talking about that same word masquerade across races, masquerade across genders, masquerading in one's own gender. Talk to me a little bit more about that word. It's a word that we don't hear very often, and it really sort of drew my attention.
Well, I think the whole issue of impersonation is at the heart of gender performance. There's a very famous theorist named Judith Butler who argues that, in fact, we are all impersonating our gender assignments, that from the minute we're born, we're told, oh, here's Tom. He's such a cute baby boy. And here's Anne. She's such an adorable baby girl. And from the moment of birth, we're told who we are, and we learn to impersonate that gender assignment. I'm not sure we can discount biology completely. That could be because I'm a mother, and I have seen how temperament and mood, habit are so early exhibiting themselves in children. Mm-hmm. And we do have statistics on the ways in which certain kinds of illnesses tend to afflict girls or boys, that they do tend to be sex-specific, which leads one to think it's not merely impersonation. But I think impersonation and masquerade are very important for understanding both race and gender.
It's when I've taught before in the past, I've often used the example of why is it okay for a little girl to be wearing overalls and construction boots and a little cap? How cute is that, right? Little flannel button-down shirt. And they say, and how cute is a little boy in a skirt and fishnets and little patent leather shoes? And everybody goes, oh, in the class. Talk to me a little bit about why it works one way and not the other way.
It's such an interesting question. It's really always been the case. And I think it has everything to do with the asymmetry of masculinity and femininity. That is, if a girl is dressing as a boy, she's aspiring upward in the human condition. The chain of being since Milton was God, man, woman, and then below that, base nature. Mm-hmm. So if you go from being a girl to impersonating a boy, you're gaining a lot of stature, a lot of grandeur, a lot of authority. And if you go from being a boy to a girl, you're moving down that chain, and it becomes comic, as in Some Like It Hot. I mean, we laugh. It's clownish. It's funny. It's a kind of abject debasement. So it's a very interesting asymmetry.
When you talked about, you know, as you're saying that, it's interesting because I'm flashing back on Jane Austen, on the Bronte sisters, and on some of those earlier writers who seemed to capture women who had no pretense of being men, women who enjoyed their femininity and somehow found strength. Can you talk a little bit more about that notion of women finding strength as women in those earlier books of literature, or not, as you perceive it?
Well, I think there are instances in all of those texts, early texts, of girls impersonating boys. Jo in Little Women is always impersonating a boy. And there are various times in Villette by Charlotte Bronte where Lucy takes on a male persona. But certainly most of the 19th century writers, and in fact most of the 20th century women writers, find an extraordinary kind of charisma in the female, in the feminine, and embracing the feminine. Very often it has to do with intimacy among women, a sense that women are freer to express affection with each other than men are to express affection with each other, a sense that the intimacy levels, the friendship levels, the attentiveness that women can give each other publicly and privately is more permissible. Mm-hmm. And part of a female culture that men have not had.
I'm also thinking about some of the books of 20th century feminist writers. I'm thinking back to The Yellow Wallpaper. Am I saying mm-hmm. that correctly? Mm-hmm. Also Margaret Atwood's Surfacing, which mm-hmm. I think explored things in a very different way. How do you see sort of the line of women passing on from those 18th century books to the 20th century books?
Well, one thing I think that's different in 20th century literature by women is a willingness to be more explicit about the body. Let's just take the two examples that you just mentioned. The Yellow Wallpaper deals with postpartum depression. The narrator has just had a baby, and she's suffering from her inability to nurture that baby because of her anxiety and her sadness, which is inexplicable to her and which ultimately drives her mad. I think that a 20th century writer like Margaret Atwood, who can deal with pregnancy or with abortion or with the sorrow of mothering or of not mothering, there's a kind of explicit dealing with the biological and its effect on the psychological that we don't find in earlier writing by women, because in the Victorian period so much was unspeakable. Mm-hmm. So that would be one major difference, it seems to me.
Tell me a little bit more about going back to Rooms of Our Own and the idea of narrative criticism. And did that format come out as you were writing, or did you begin to write in that style?
I think one thing that happened to me in the 90s is that I stopped getting pleasure reading feminist criticism. It started to sound jargony. It started to sound abstract, highly theoretical and elitist. I was not always understanding it. My students were struggling with it. And I thought, what's gone wrong here? I mean, feminism is supposed to link women inside the academy with women outside the academy. It should be a pleasure to be reading it. And I was thinking about, well, who does give me pleasure? And I thought, well, Virginia Woolf. I still love reading and teaching A Room of One's Own, and my students love reading it. So I went back to a room and I saw there this effort to deal with ideas and history and evaluating women's situation, but to deal with it in a very concrete way in terms of one person's response to the various people she meets and various experiences she has in the course of 2 days. So I really got the idea from Woolf, and it was an idea to enliven criticism, to make it more fun, mm-hmm. more like fiction.
You talk about that notion of capturing time or a short span of time. Of course, I think of Mrs. Dalloway, and I think of The Hours by Michael Cunningham, right?
Yes.
How did you feel when The Hours came out? How did you feel about both the book and then subsequently the movie in terms of capturing Virginia Woolf and the relationship between the two?
Well, most Woolf scholars really disliked the movie intensely. I loved the movie. I mean, I thought it was terrific. I had one caveat, which is I disliked the fact that it began and ended with such a glamorized version of her suicide. Because I think, as a teacher, I'm always thinking about what's the effect of this on my students. And Woolf, really, the suicide was something that had everything to do with recurrent bouts of manic depression, on the one hand, and the fact that she was convinced the Nazis were going to come over. They were already bombing England, but she was convinced they were going to come over. And
what year did she commit suicide? 19...
Woolf, Woolf committed suicide when she was convinced that she knew that they were, she was hearing the bombs overhead. She was writing about hearing the bombs overhead, and she was convinced they were going to come, and they were going to put her in prison. I once went to the library at in Stanford, and I was doing research on Woolf, and I found a Nazi handbook about what they were going to do when they captured England. And in the handbook, they had listed the people they were going to put in concentration camps. And her name and her husband's name were on that list. So she was not paranoid. She was married to a Jewish man, Leonard Woolf. She was herself working as a feminist and as an anti-fascist activist. And she was not wrong. The suicide, in other words, was a very complex event. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a beautiful, bucolic walking into a calm river. It was a very, very difficult decision made under extraordinarily complex situations. So I didn't like that. But I thought the rest of the movie was just terrific, and I thought the novel was wonderful.
The way you speak about Virginia Woolf is with an incredible amount of passion for her work. Are there some other authors that rise up for you in that same sense?
I am very devoted to Toni Morrison. I have had the privilege of getting to know her a little bit personally, and I love Beloved, which is a book I teach to freshmen, and it's a very difficult book. Linguistically, extremely complex. At points, it's almost, in its imagism, like poetry. And yet they respond enormously to this book, even though it's very complicated. I love her fiction. I also think she's a wonderful critic. She has a book called Playing in the Dark about the ways in which we've always studied images of African Americans in literature, but we very rarely study images of whiteness in literature. And what happens when we think about whiteness as a race as much as blackness? She's a terrific, she's one of my very favorites.
Anyone else that comes to mind?
There's a young poet named Jacqueline Ashero who I learned about when I was writing poetry after Auschwitz, who I think is just a fantastically interesting contemporary poet, partly because she works in highly formal structures. So terza rima or the sonnet or psalms, she uses extremely conventional forms, and then she sort of breaks out of them in very interesting ways. So I would think she'd be she's a very interesting writer.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Susan Gubar, Distinguished Professor of English at Indiana University, author of a myriad of books, including Mad Woman in the Attic, along with Sandra Gilbert, and editor of the Norton Anthology of Women's Literature, along with Sandra Gilbert as well. A new book of hers will be coming out in the fall of 06. That's Rooms of Our Own. And she's working on another book called The Biography of Judas, which we'll talk more about in just a few minutes. Let's take a break and listen to another one of Susan's favorite pieces called Scandalize My Name. It's being sung by Jesse Norman and Kathleen Battle. Susan, why did you pick this piece?
Well, they're two of the greatest singers we have in America today, Kathleen Battle and Jesse Norman. It's also an old spiritual, and it captures a kind of mockery about sisterhood. It seems to me that's very healthy. We want to care about each other. The old idea that sisterhood is powerful has to be revamped, though. We aren't exactly sisters, but we're something like sisters.
I met my sister the other day. I gave her my right hand. But just as soon as ever my back was turned, she scandalized my name. Now do you call that a sister?
No, no.
Do you call that a sister?
No, no.
Do you call that a sister?
No, no.
She scandalized my name.
Well. Let me tell you.
You've been listening to Scandalize My Name, sung by Kathleen Battle and Jesse Norman. You're also listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Susan Gubar. Just before we listen to that piece, you talked about the fact that sisterhood needs to be revamped a little bit, that we have a different perspective in this century than we did in the 70s. Talk to me a little bit more about that.
Well, it's because of what we've been talking about throughout our conversation, the multiplications of differences between and among women. Think of all the differences within yourself on a given day in your attitude toward any one thing, like your daughter. You have many different attitudes towards each of your children in any one day, and there are many differences within ourselves and between ourselves that make sisterhood a kind of anachronistic model for feminism.
I'm going to shift a little bit. I'm very curious about the new book that you're working on called The Biography of Judas, or it is a biography of Judas. What led you to explore Judas?
Well, it does seem like a very eccentric topic in relation to my intellectual history and my publishing history. But in a way, Judas is the madman in the Western civilization. He's the madman in the attic of Western culture. He's the person that has always been considered monstrous, evil, the betrayer. He is, in other words, a pariah figure, a kind of scapegoat. I think partly I've always been interested in stereotyped figures, and he has been stereotyped as the arch villain, the betrayer in The Passion, after all. The other reason has everything to do with the book I wrote about poetry after Auschwitz. I was thinking about what could possibly have inspired genocide in the context of Western culture. What figure, if you had to think of a muse of the Holocaust, a figure that inspired the Holocaust, would it be, could it be possible that anti-Semitism has something to do with the figure of Judas, who has been used to represent the Jews as the killers of Jesus, the betrayers of Christ? I now have decided, after much study of Judas, that no, he cannot be said to be the cause of the Holocaust. But he has had a very interesting history. So this book goes from the Gospels, from Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, through medieval ballads and legends and plays, to Renaissance painting in Italy, to Enlightenment philosophy and contemporary film, trying to study how Judas evolves through 20 centuries.
And do you draw any comparisons or correlations to looking at feminism by studying Judas, or is it?
No, I don't think feminism really enters into it. Judas is very interesting in terms of the history of masculinity, in particular Jewish masculinity. So I'm still thinking about gender, but I'm not really thinking about feminism in this book.
And what are you? Do you have other plans beyond the biography of Judas once you? You're working on this right now. Do you have another project in mind?
Well, Judas is a book that I will be writing for the next year or so, and I'm collecting incredible images, particularly Renaissance painting, but also beautiful, beautiful paintings and woodcuts from earlier periods. After Judas, I think I'll probably return to feminism. I'm not quite sure what I'll do. I have in my mind, I don't know if you've ever seen Mel Brooks's Producers. Yeah. Have you ever seen that? Well, there's a very hilarious show-stopping number on Broadway called Little Old Lady Land. And it's these ladies with walkers who do a number, a dance number with their walkers. And they're all ancient, you know, types. And it's very funny because, of course, they're Broadway show-stopping numbers. So they're tap dancing with their walkers.
With the walkers.
And I thought it would be fun to use some of my feminist training in studying literature to think about the image of the little old lady. After all, that's where I'm going to have to go. I don't want to go gently into that good night without becoming a little old lady first. So that's something just on the edge of my mind.
Sounds interesting. Let me ask you, too. You've talked about how the perception of feminism has been complicated with intersections of other studies, critical race theory, class, other issues of gender and sexuality. What do you see in the next 5 to 10 years as we move more firmly into the 21st century? What do you see being the major issues that feminism is going to be facing and some of the turns that you predict it might take?
First, I think we're going to have to deal with globalism, the ways in which women from different countries have different needs and different problems and certain commonalities. Two-thirds of the women around the globe, let me put this differently, among the numbers of people illiterate around the globe, two-thirds of them are women. These are issues that are going to have to be raised by feminists, the ways in which women are still in many countries debarred from equal access to education. And I'm not just speaking about higher education because I'm talking about illiteracy. So I would say globalism. That would be one. Two, I would say the whole issue of bioengineering is going to affect men and women and families enormously in the years to come. And there are a lot of ethical questions and questions about control over the body and who will be able to control the body, about egg banks, about sperm banks, about in vitro fertilization, about aging and dying and who chooses and how chooses and, you know, the role women will play in constructing their beginnings and their ends of life. Those are going to be major conversations among feminists who are interested in health and also in issues of ethics. Mm-hmm. And I think the third issue is going to be sexuality. I think that for both men and women, questions of freedom of choice in sexuality and of alternative families are going to become extremely important conversations. Adoption, who can adopt, how gay families can evolve, how they might evolve differently. These are things that will be talked about quite a bit.
Okay. And what do you see as being for young women, especially young American women who are in university today, what do you see as some of the major challenges that they're facing at this point?
Many of my undergraduates will say to me, feminism has made its mark. Our lives are fine now. And I say to them, come back to me 5 years after you graduate, because the same problem is still the problem that it always was for women and has been for many years. How do you combine a professional, ambitious life with childcare, with a loving family, a marriage? These are still extremely difficult, complex issues for women.
You've been listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter. Our guest is Susan Gubar, Distinguished Professor of English at Indiana University, the author of many books, including The Mad Woman in the Attic, the Norton Anthology of Literature, which she co-authored with Sandra Gilbert. Also, Race Changes, Poetry from Auschwitz, the upcoming Rooms of Our Own, and one that we will look forward to in the next few years, the biography of Judas. Thank you so much for being on the show, Susan.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in June of 2006. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blackland McCord, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.